So today I want to talk about the gravitational action, and the reason for this is I want to discuss a little bit about black hole thermodynamics, and I'm going to talk about the Euclidean path integral approach for that, so I need to think about gravitational actions. So you may well have already met the Einstein-Hilbert action. No, yes, yes. Good, so again, this is going to be a relatively straightforward lecture. But the other reason for bringing or highlighting the gravitational action is because when you deal with modifications of gravity, and that's a very sort of significant subset of gravitational research, quite often you do this at the level of a Lagrangian or an action by modifying the Einstein-Hilbert action. So I just want to review again the Einstein-Hilbert action. I also want to signpost the next lecture topic by talking about the boundary terms that you get. Just checking, did you do the boundary term for the Einstein action? No, okay, good. Something's gonna be new, which we'll do next time, because that also involves yet again some development of mathematical theory in terms of the physics and maths of submanifolds. So just to recall, if you're going to do an integral, we have to have a measure. And on the manifold, of course, our space is curved. So we have to just be very clear about what the measure is. And normally, if we were doing just QFT, we might have something like D4X, which would just be a coordinate volume, which is not physically invariant. That's something that depends on the local chart. However, when we talked about forms, I talked about the epsilon tensor, and the epsilon tensor itself, the non-curly font, the backslash epsilon, was just equal to plus or minus one or zero, depending on the permutation of the indices. But if we wanted to have something tensorial, we multiplied it by the square root of g. And at the time, I commented that that gave you a volume element. And so, if you take D4X, again, you know, you will have seen this, but you're sort of now seeing it with slightly different eyes, having talked about forms, about volume, etc. So this is coordinate invariant, and it's, you know, this is the appropriate tensor form. So D4X prime is the determinant of dx prime by dx, D4X. But of course, root G also transforms. So now, if we think about, now that we've got our measure, and then we think about varying our geometry, then we use this identity, again, I'm assuming you've seen this, so I'm not going to dwell on it too much. But to get the variation of a determinant, we use this matrix identity that the determinant of a matrix is the x of the trace of the log of the matrix. So delta of det g is therefore equal to det g. So we have x trace log, delta of x plus something is the same exponential times delta of what's sitting in the exponent. That's delta of trace log g. And then that is det g, g inverse delta g. And again, it's the trace of that. So again, I'm just, you know, using exponentials and logs in our normal familiar way. But I now want to just turn g inverse delta g into g delta g inverse. And I put in the indices there so that they're kind of ready and waiting for the next step. So our canonical example of this a Lagrangian for a massless scalar is just a kinetic term. So all we have is simply the gradient of phi, the magnitude or the modulus, the norm of the gradient of phi. So therefore, our action I might not always remember to write mod g, but it's understood. Our action is the integral of this Lagrangian with the right measure. So I think sometimes you see this action partitioned differently. You might see it partitioned as root gl, but I guess that's more of the field theorist's way of doing it. From a gravitational perspective, you definitely couple these together, because this is the invariant volume measure, and that's sort of the extra stuff that you're putting in. As long as you're consistent, it shouldn't matter, but I'm just in case you've seen the other way of grouping things together, I just want to emphasize this is the way, if you like, the convention that I'm using, but it's motivated from the differential geometry. Doesn't make sense to put a root g in with fields. Okay, so from our Lagrangian perspective, we vary this action, and then we look at the variation and ask that vanishes. So delta s, I look in here and I say, well, I can vary phi, so that's going to give me here going to give me a phi comma a delta phi comma b gab. I'm using the fact that g is symmetric there. Just sort of swap the indices around. So I vary each phi in turn, but then use symmetry to just write it as one term. But I can also vary the geometry. So that gives me this term. But then I can also vary root g, because that's saying that if my geometry distorts, so does my volume. And so if I look here, this is delta of det g. So that tells me delta of the root of the determinant is going to be a half, 1 over root determinant. So I guess I should put my minus sign in here and be very strict with myself. And then I've got to vary delta of minus g. So on the top line, I get, reading off from here, det of g, or minus det of minus g, gab delta gab. But this is, of course, just minus a half root g, gab, delta, g inverse. So the final part of this variation is minus a half times a half grad phi squared GAB delta GAB. So I now see that I have two parts of this variation. I've got a delta phi part and I've got a delta GAB part. So we do the usual integration by parts for the delta phi piece. So I get that my delta S, I'm just going to focus on the delta phi bit. Sorry, let me keep the A's. So I integrate by parts. So that pulls the other derivative onto the phi. So then I've got delta phi. And I've also got a total derivative. Should have a GAB in there, shouldn't I? So the reason I've added in this total derivative is just because I want to make a point, which is that we normally, we integrate this up. So we integrate up the total derivative and we get a term that just depends on delta phi at the boundary. And the rules of the Lagrangian game are you vary your fields with the constraint that the variation vanishes on the boundary. And so that term just vanishes. And all you're left with now is this term here. And so we say that delta S is the integral of the functional derivative, delta S by delta phi, delta phi. So again, question, you done functional derivatives? Yeah, okay, so you're happy.
What did you write for the second term in the integral? What is it?
Is this one?
Comma b,
yeah, it's raised, it's the index raised, yeah. So you can sort of see that I've just pulled that phi comma a downstairs and the g inverse together. Just saving on writing. So you know, this is very much the standard picture from field theory, and so your equation of motion is the functional derivative with respect to the field that you're interested in is zero. And in this case, that functional derivative is 1 over root g dA, root g dA phi, which is just the wave operator acting on phi. So that is exactly what you would expect for a massless field. The only proviso here is that you have this root g. This is kind of what's giving you the connection coefficients. And of course, this is really GAB dB. So you have your curve geometry implicit in that expression. So it's the wave operator acting on a scalar in a curve background. But it is so similar to the flat space wave operator as it's seems that you're probably wondering why I'm making the point. And I guess I'm just making the point because a wave operator on different spin fields looks different. So what's left? Is the other part, the geometrical bit, and that is a half of phi comma A phi comma B minus a half d phi squared gab delta gab. So what this is actually a half of the stress tensor of the field. Now, I'm not saying that's equal to zero because this is just the variation of this particular field with respect to the metric. We have to think about, is the field coupling to gravity? And if it's coupling to gravity, then we need, if you like, a left-hand side to that equation of motion. So here, because you've seen it before, I'm not going to make a big meal out of it, but essentially when you're if you don't know what a Lagrangian or action is, what you often do is you take what's called an effective field theory approach and you just write down whatever physically sensible quantities you can think of, okay? So how would I construct a gravitational Lagrangian? Well, it's got to be some scalar. So let me just think about what sensible scalars could I have. I could have a constant. A bit boring, but it is a scalar. The obvious one is, of course, the Ricci scalar. But I could put R phi, I could put R squared, RAB squared, RABCD squared. I mean, there's a whole load of things that I could put down. These are higher derivative. In that are physical observable, the metric. The Ricci scalar is second order in derivatives of the metric. So if you square anything Ricci or Riemann, it's now fourth order. So for now, I'm going to say, well, actually, we're going to be rather nervous about doing that because a fourth order derivative is going to give rise to equations of motion that are fourth order, and that could be problematic. But I just wanted to point out at this stage, if we're just being quite agnostic, we can think of quite a lot of different scalars to put in. So for example, this is the simplest modified gravity, and it was the first one considered, which is called Brands-Dickey. So we'll just focus in on what we know, which is R. so I get the variation of the Ricci scalar is going to have two parts. I'm going to get part from the variation of the curvature and part from the variation of this inverse metric that's hiding in there. So remember, when we defined Riemann, our Riemann had one index up and three down. And that's the geometric object. It was a map from three copies of the tangent space and one copy of the cotangent space into the reals. So when we get Ricci by tracing along the first and third indices, the canonical geometric Ricci has both indices downstairs. So that's why I've written it this way and not just a straight trace one up, one down. Because this is your canonical curvature. So here.
I know the one up, one down is like a curvature two form or whatever, but if you write it one up, one down, I think it's implicit that you can't say this is a trace for the Ricci tangent.
You mean the Ricci? Yeah, but then you have to start thinking about what additional copies of the metric are hiding in there. And because this Riemann, which is defined as a commutator of covariant derivatives, right? You define it as a commutator of covariant derivatives acting on a vector. So this is, if you like, this is where you're just dealing with the geometry. And this would be true whether or not you had a metric, whether or not you had the metric connection. So this, right, is also defined for a non-metric connection and for a geometry without a metric. So that is why I think that's probably the best way of answering it. For sure, you could put one up, one down, but then you would be doing the same thing anyway, because the only way you get one up, one down is if you have a metric on your manifold, right? Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, it's because I'm sort of being a little bit, pedantic here, but it's about saying that these things are defined whether or not you have a metric. And that's, I guess, what I mean by them being the sort of basic fundamental objects. But we do have a metric, and you're quite right, you could have put RA up, one up, one down, but then you would have still had to deal with the fact that you'd raised an index, so you'd introduced a G inverse. So, but quite a nice point to highlight, actually. Okay, so this term here, I'm really happy about. So I'm going to put a little smiley face there because I know that I'm already halfway to the Einstein equations, right, with that. And then my root G effort on the top board is going to give me the other half of the Einstein tensor. So all you have to worry about is this object here. Now, I'm going to just go over how you get that, because whilst it ends up being irrelevant for pure Einstein gravity, the moment you add anything else like a Brans-Dickey scalar or higher derivative terms, you need to grapple with what the variation of RAB is. So there's a technique which I guess was more fashionable in the past, called normal coordinates. And normal coordinates are just a local inertial frame. In which the first derivative of the metric vanishes with respect to the coordinates, but the second derivative doesn't necessarily. So this is really just like taking a tangent to a curve, in essence. You're taking some linear approximation. And so locally, you're saying just locally for that moment, that instant, you're in an inertial frame. But of course, if you have any acceleration, either you're on an accelerating trajectory or the geometry around you has some sort of distortion, then your second derivatives won't be zero. So that's where the curvature shows up. So if I think about what that means, it means that my gamma ABC is zero. Again, let me just emphasize that's at some point P. I'm going to do this calculation at a specific point. But gamma ABC comma D is not zero necessarily, right? It might be because you might be in flat space, but it's not necessarily zero. So therefore, if I ask, sorry, my Ricci scalar, which is the contraction of the Riemann, I can write that as gamma A BD comma A minus gamma ABA comma D. In normal coordinates. So that tells me that delta R is delta gamma is sort of two first derivatives of delta gamma. But because I'm in normal coordinates, and delta gamma is a tensor, I can replace my partial derivative with a covariant derivative. And now this final expression is covariant, it's geometric. Yep.
I don't know if this question, so this is more of a conceptual question. Mm. We have like G, A, B, comma, C, so it has one derivative on the metric, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if we have one derivative on the metric, we're calling this a local inertial. Usually inertial means we don't have any sort of acceleration.
Mm-hmm.
This seems more like, I don't know if it's the wrong way to think about it, but if it's like a first derivative, I think of it more like a velocity.
Yeah.
So, why are we calling it an inertial frame if it's like...
Well, it's sort of local in the sense that if you're moving, right, at any point, you could match, you know, at any given time, a single point, a single instant, right? You can match your trajectory with someone going at a completely constant velocity, right? And someone at a constant velocity is in an inertial frame, yeah? So that's why I added the P, actually. It might help to, you know, to clock that thing. So it's just saying that, yes, you might be sort of accelerating on a racetrack, right? But at every single point in of your trajectory, you could be matched to someone else going at a constant speed. And it's only saying that that sort of correspondence is only spot on for that given instant. But, you know, the discrepancy, if you like, by which it's not spot on in a neighboring instant is the second derivative. So it's really like taking this gradient. It's just a sort of linear approximation at a given moment in time and space. But again, using the fact that coordinates are just a way of labeling your geometry, if you manage to derive a covariant expression in one coordinate system, it is true in all coordinate systems. So here, this expression is not covariant, it's not geometrically independent. However, in the coordinate chart we're using, at P, only at P, this is exactly the same as that. And that is covariant. So it's kind of a bit of a trick, you know, you're setting up some convenient coordinates. But if you're ever uncomfortable with normal coordinates, just forget about them and do the full four terms in your Riemann and vary them all, group everything back together, and you'll get exactly the same result. So it is, it's just a trick. So, but if you're not happy, do the long calculation. I have back in the day. Sorry, there was someone had their hand up first.
I don't quite understand why the delta gamma is a tensor.
So if you recall, I think way back when I did the coordinate transformation on the gammas, you got something that was covariant in the sense of you got the right dx by dx primes. Then you got a second term, which was a second derivative of the coordinate transformation. So if you have two different connections, right, so you have gamma 1 and gamma 2, both of these will have a bit that's geometric plus this non-geometric bit. So what am I going to call it? Just schematically d squared of coordinate transform, right? This has geometric plus same d squared x prime of x, right? So when you subtract them, those bits cancel.
So it's the fact that it's a variation that makes it.
It's the fact that the bit that by which your gamma is not a tensor is basically just a function of your coordinate transformation. This is just a sort of second derivative. Yeah. Yeah.
Just to clarify, this is not a statement about normal coordinates.
No, this is completely generic. Yeah.
You said mm-hmm. you use the analogy of when someone's has an acceleration and then you want to match their speed with you go
at a given time. Yeah.
Yeah, at any given time you just match their speed. And you could say that inertial frame could be. that person's frame on that particular moment. But I don't understand why if the first derivative, I know this is an analogy, but you call the first derivative of the metric as the velocity here. I know by definition the covariant derivative of GAB should be zero, but now you're saying the partial derivative at point P is zero, which means.
Hang on, let me just try. Just think about it. You've got your Ferrari, right? And you're zooming off, yeah? So you have an x dot of t, but then you have the I don't know, what are we going to call it? It's a Fiat or something, which is going just at x equals vt, right? So here this is just v. And all you're saying is that, you know, one particular point, x dot minus v, you know, mod x dot minus v is zero, yeah? And that's all it's saying. X dot minus V is zero. But X, the acceleration, is X double dot, and that's not zero. That's all it's saying.
I'm saying, why can't we always find a point at which the partial derivative of the metric is zero? Because you're saying, that's the whole point. You're saying you're at a coordinate in which GAB, C becomes zero at a particular
point. At a given point, yeah.
Change coordinates.
Yeah, you can always change coordinates. Just like I can change what my the zero of my velocity. It's just a choice. And you can sort of rescale your coordinates or whatever to match up the GAB, C in each direction. But having done that, you've finished. And so that means that you can't alter the second derivative, just like there. I can match an inertial frame, constant velocity, with the Ferrari at any point on its trajectory, but I cannot match the acceleration. So best to take offline if it's not. So that means That means that the variation of our Ricci is just given in terms of a difference of the connections, sort of the background, the new connection with the background. So to get delta gamma, again in normal coordinates, so let me just say, in normal coordinates, this first derivative of G vanishes, but the first derivative of delta G is not going to vanish necessarily. So when I'm varying these terms, my first variation hits the G inverse, but that one, I'm not, that's not relevant because it's multiplied by something that's zero in normal coordinates. So all I get is the variation, the derivatives of the variation in the metric, which again is equal to a half times covariant derivatives of the metric, which is now a covariant expression. So my last step is just going to be to turn this variation into a variation of delta G inverse, which is what I've actually got in my action. And delta G is equal to minus G. Basically equal to minus the variation of the metric inverse. And so putting together, I'll just leave you to fill in the algebraic steps. Something wrong with my notes here. I'm guessing that's what it should be. So you now see that really what's left is just that the variation of R is just a whole load of derivatives here. So when I take my variation of R root G, my first term was the one I was happy with right at the beginning from the variation of the Ricci scalar. My second term comes from the variation of root G. And then I have a term which is giving me, this term is like the, sorry, that term is the wave operator acting on the trace of delta G inverse. And I end up with the sort of this taking the derivative of each index. So I'm just wondering whether there should be a half in front of that based on this. If I trace this, surely I get a half in front of this last piece. There's not one there. Not sure about that. I'll check it for next time. Okay. So we see now that we've got what we wanted. We've got the Einstein tensor, but we've also got this extra term. However, this here can be packaged as a total derivative. So I've got my root g. So this is, in fact, dA of root g dA of delta g minus grad B delta G AB with a root G. So I end up with Einstein and boundary. So from the purposes of just trying to get a gravitational action, that's sort of the end of the story. Question?
What do you mean by G inverse lowering CCB?
That means that, I'll put it in the top corner actually. I need to, there's a difference between varying a matrix and its inverse, right? So that's the first point. And so here, what I need to be doing is varying G inverse. So what this really means is delta G inverse AB is really taking this, where this is now delta G inverse. So it's saying take delta G and then lower its indices. So that's what that means. And again, also, when I've written G inverse, what I mean is delta GAB, again, with the inverse implicitly understood, and tracing it. Yeah, the minus sign, I think, sort of comes here because what I want to do, I said, yeah, to fill in the algebraic steps yourself, but I'm changing these delta G's into delta G inverses, which is where the confusion about where the indices are located comes in, but kind of all comes out in the wash. So I get my Einstein equations if I multiply this action by a 1 over 16 pi G. So hang on, let me reorder this. D4x minus gr. So I got that 1 over 16 pi g, which came from the energy momentum tensor constant. So just for sort of completeness, if you wanted to add the lambda, that's how you would do it. So I'm going to use this manipulation that we've just done. So just don't hang on to them, keep them in mind. when we talk later about gravitational perturbation theory, we're going to use those expressions. You see delta R A B. You see you've got, except I probably will keep it just as to delta of the metric rather than the inverse, but you can see you've got a wave operator acting on delta G. So that is exactly what you would expect for a massless field. The other pieces in that, you have to sort of do a little bit of manipulation, but you end up reducing them to something which is a gauge choice and some Riemann and Ricci terms. And so that is what generalizes a massless wave operator to curved geometries for a tensor spin two field. So we're going to come back to this. So that's why I wanted to do that explicitly. And the other thing I wanted to emphasize was, of course, the boundary term. So our boundary term, just to bring it out, involves derivatives of the fluctuation of G inverse. So this N is normal to the boundary. So by the rules of the game of Lagrangians, we're in a bit of a sticky spot here, because we can set delta g's to zero on the boundary, but we actually shouldn't really be setting derivatives of delta g, and particularly not normal derivatives of delta g, because normal derivatives of delta g depend on delta g in the neighborhood of the boundary. And so we're being too over prescriptive if we insist that, you know, from the rules of the game of Lagrangians, if we insist that that vanishes. So, what are we doing for time? Oh, time. So I will, next time we'll deal with this. But I just want to finish off this time by giving, if you like, a sort of taster about why it's really important to get the boundary right, by thinking about the black hole again.
Sorry, what did you write next to the coin? Expected
to
be there in the boundary term, second term?
A root G. I'd forgotten to write the root G in it. It's a root G. Just before the grad.
Yeah, before the grad. What is it?
It's a root G. Oh, that's a root G. Oh. Yeah. I missed it, and so I squeezed it in. But it's not very clear, is it? So I mean, here, and I'm just going to give a sort of somewhat more heuristic overview, but one of the ways of approaching black hole thermodynamics, given that it involves a sort of interaction between quantum fields and gravity, is an approach taken or developed by Gary Gibbons and Stephen Hawking in the 70s. And it's really like it's just a path integral approach. So the idea is that you are saying that just like if you sort of go back to quantum theory, where you say to get from A to B, you integrate over all the paths, you wait by an action, and then the dominant trajectory is the one that's stationary, which is the classical solution. And then you have other contributions coming around. So here, they're sort of saying the same thing, but rather than having an A and a B, their idea is that you fix a boundary and then you look at all the geometries that kind of asymptote to that boundary and you sum over those geometries weighted by the action, and then your classical solutions will be stationary points of the action. That's more on, but that's kind of the dominant, the saddle point to your path integral. So that was their idea, knowing what the action was, right? So there's a couple of very obvious problems with this if you just have the Einstein-Hilbert action. Okay, so what's the first problem? Einstein-Hilbert action is an integral of R, and R equals zero for vacuum solutions. So that was one problem. And then the other thing that they sort of decided to do, because this is pretty common anyway in field theory, they decided to Wick rotate, and then they hit a slightly different problem. Which is that the fluctuations around a given geometry are, from a Euclidean action perspective, are completely unbounded below. You can sort of do local conformal rescalings and make the action as negative as you want. So it's not even really very well defined as a path integral approach. Now, lesser mortals would have given up at this point, but not Stephen and Gary. They just decided, no, we're going to forge ahead and we're going to see, you know, how we can make this work. And I think the real reason that they felt there was something in this is actually hidden in the Euclidean Schwarzschild solution. So their argument went, what happens at R equals 2gm? So R equals, if I now focus in here, what's happening at R equals 2gm? The denominator here of dr squared is going to zero linearly as you approach 2gm. So this suggests a coordinate change. That you take the square root as your new coordinate. So if I do that, then 2 rho d rho is equal to lambda dr, so dr squared over r minus 2gm and times 2gm, because that's roughly what your radial metric is near the horizon. Well, that's going to be 2gm. R minus 2gm is just rho squared on lambda. Meanwhile, dr squared is 4 rho squared d rho squared on lambda squared. So therefore, one of those lambdas cancels, the rho squareds cancel. So it tells me that lambda is actually I think, HEM. So now I get on my metric d rho squared plus rho squared over 4gm squared d tau squared. And if, go over here because I know you guys can't see it. So if I define phi is tau over 4gm, then I have a conical singularity, which means that the origin is not smooth, but it looks like this. Unless the periodicity of delta phi is 2 pi, i.e. the periodicity of tau is 8 pi gm. Now, having spotted that, if you're doing quantum field theory in a thermal equilibrium, your Euclidean time is periodically identified, and it's periodically identified with a periodicity which is 1 over the periodicity of Euclidean time, okay? So that tells you, this, if you like, it's a signal of thermal equilibrium. In, if every, you know, in the various constants, which if you put back your C's, your H bars, and your Boltzmann, whatever constant, gives you a temperature which is exactly the temperature that Hawking calculated in 73-74 by doing a direct Lorentzian quantum field theory computation. So
there, and then you said it's a
quantum.
Sorry, it's
just an angle.
Yeah, but why is it a singularity if delta phi? It is not a singularity if
it's delta phi. It is a conical singularity unless the periodicity of phi, unless it's a normal polar angle.
What is this phi?
It's what it's just I've replaced right at the top if I define phi as tau over 4gm. Because then I'm just saying that my metric is d rho squared plus rho squared d phi squared. So if phi has periodicity 2 pi, then that is just the metric of the origin of polar coordinates, which we know is not singular. If phi does not have periodicity 2 pi, you have a conical singularity. So here, if this is my phi, yeah, this is my origin. If phi has periodicity 2 pi, that's fine. If it has periodicity less than 2 pi, let's say it's this, then you've, when you re-identify like that, you've got a conical singularity. So that is why they stuck with this description, because if you Euclideanize the Schwarzschild metric, you end up with a periodic Euclidean time in a very natural way that agrees with the Hawking temperature of the black hole. And so they figured they're onto something. So they better go back and try, and they just skated over the negative modes and went back and tried to make sense of this first problem, which is the fact that if you just take the Einstein-Hilbert action, you're not distinguishing between a lot of different geometries. So, and then at the same time, you've got this flag planted about this boundary term. And so their solution was to come up with a boundary term that you add to the action that both deals with that Lagrangian variational issue and deals with the fact that you now don't get the same answer for Schwarzschild as you do for the vacuum. And then I better stop.